There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit RightRug.com. RiteRug.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring. Right.
Hey guys, this is Elena.
And it's Candace.
And you're listening to Cousins on Crime. It's been a while since we've had an episode.
I know. I've missed you so much, Lena.
I know. These little tidbits of messages that we've gotten over the last few weeks is not enough.
I know. It really isn't. I've really missed recording, and I've missed seeing your face and talking true crime with you. So I'm glad to be back. Sorry for the absence, everyone, but thank you for your understanding and letting us have a little time off, with our family, and it was wonderful. So we're back.
Yeah. Yes. So, honestly, it's a little difficult to find time to work on getting these cases prepared and to talk about and everything.
This is not our day job. We don't get paid for this.
No.
We have, families and kids and crazy schedules.
Thanksgiving and holidays.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, hopefully we can get back into the groove and, so we'll get right on it.
Let's do it.
This case was pretty popular, with the internet sleuths. When it happened, it was a time frame in 2014 when the sleuthing really was, I guess, getting hit hard. I saw just a couple of podcasts and YouTube videos about this case, so you may or may not have heard it. It has been on, I think, Oxygen and Investigative Discoveries, but so, we're going to be talking about Jessica Chambers from Cortland, Mississippi.
Oh.
She was born on February 2nd of 1995. She lived in a small town of Cortland, Mississippi, where there was a population of about 500 people.
Wow.
Yes, tiny. Small town. She had blonde hair and blue eyes. She had 3 older brothers, 2 older sisters, and a younger sister.
Oh, wow.
I think a couple of them were half or step. I'm not sure. In high school, she was a cheerleader and she played softball. She started working at Goodies department store.
Oh, Goodies. Do you remember Goodies?
Yeah.
I don't even think they're around anymore.
I don't know.
The last time I was in Mississippi, I didn't see one.
Oh, yeah, I guess I wasn't really even paying attention, but she was well-liked by everyone. She is described as outgoing, spunky, she was a cheerleader, so she had a lot of personality. She got along with everyone, and everyone liked her. She had fun with life and had a big heart. Jessica's sister says she was always cracking jokes and making funny faces, and there was just no way to have a bad day in front of her.
Aww.
Her mother says she never treated anybody different. It didn't matter what you had done, because she wasn't a judgmental person. Everyone deserved a fair chance. And even with all of the sweet and positive things that friends and family has described Jessica as, she did have her fair share of troubles. With a string of bad experiences and heartaches, Jessica went down a rough road and started hanging with the wrong people. Jessica's mother also said, nobody ever claimed that Jessica was a saint. There are reports that Jessica was known to have sold drugs from time to time and had an arrest on her record.
How old was she again?
19.
Oh.
Small town, Jessica. Not a lot to do. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, December 6th, 2014, Jessica Chambers, she was 19 years old. That night, two men came upon her burning car in a ditch.
Whoa.
On a two-lane country road. So they stopped their truck. One of the men looked around for a person. He didn't see anybody. And the other one called the fire department. They said in the testimony, the man driving the truck, he said he came over the hill and saw a tree on fire. And so when they got closer, they realized there was a car there too. And he stopped and he looked behind him and he's like, well, was there a person that I missed? Like,
yeah.
So he looked around, didn't
see
anybody.
So was the car, like, up against the tree or by the tree?
Yes, it was. Yeah, I believe it was by the tree or up against the tree. Yeah, in a ditch.
I mean, I've seen a burning car before, and it's like there's something that you feel like violated for the owner, you know, when someone's car is up in flames. I just can't imagine.
Yeah.
You know, stumbling upon that at night and tree being aflame as well.
Yeah, very eerie. And, you know, in the woods, too.
Yeah, yeah.
So as first responders arrived and began to extinguish the fire, it's reported that Jessica came walking towards them from the woods about 30 feet away from the car.
What?
And to backtrack just a little bit, the men who called the fire department, they were just there at the scene for like a couple minutes and then they left to get to where they were going. Yeah.
So they didn't see her.
They didn't see her. He looked for her but never saw anybody. And they were like, they called the fire department and then got out of there. So the first responders saw Jessica walking towards them out of the woods. And all she was wearing was her underwear. She was burned beyond recognition, and she just kept saying, help me, help me.
Oh my gosh.
She wasn't described as being on fire at that point. She just had second degree and third degree burns all over her. Paramedics were able to communicate with her. They asked her, who did this to you? And she said, what sounded like Eric or Derek. One paramedic said he sat there and held her hand. He said that's all he could do. And this was the paramedic that he was around the same age as Jessica. He knew who Jessica Chambers was, but he didn't know her to be Jessica Chambers because he couldn't recognize her. And he asked her, what's your name? And she said, Jessica Chambers, because she couldn't speak very well. And so when she said her name, he's like, then he recognized it was her. So he says, sweetheart, it's going to be okay. And she said, I'm going to die.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, so sad. She was taken to a Memphis hospital about 60 miles away from Cortland. She suffered burns on about 93% of her body.
Oh my gosh.
The only parts of her body that weren't burnt was her buttocks and the top of the back of her legs. She was sitting and the seat was protecting that area. Also around her groin area.
Because her legs were closed.
Was not burned. You know, we can speculate.
We are investigators, Elena. We know.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So Jessica's family was able to get to the hospital as she arrived by CareFlight. they were able to say their goodbyes, and she died the next morning.
Oh, Lord.
So examiners found that a flammable liquid had been poured on her body, up her nose and down her throat. I'm not exactly sure how true that was, but that was in a report that I read. And listening to the medical examiner, she talked about how there was soot all down her throat, her larynx, and all of that. So I'm not exactly sure where this report of the liquid being poured on her, how they figured that out. But moving on, Jessica's car keys were later found on December 8th, 2 days later, along the road near the crime scene, by a man walking with his child. Her cell phone was examined by authorities in order to determine her movements on December 6th, and a timeline of her day was reported. They determined that she had spent the morning with two friends. She had been home just before 5 p.m. She took a nap in a chair in her living room and after watching CSI with her mother.
Vibes.
Lazy afternoon. It was a Saturday, just to kind of put that in more perspective. After answering a call on her cell phone, her mother couldn't recall if it was a text or a phone call. But after the notification on her phone, Jessica got up, went to the restroom, and came out and was talking on the phone. And then she told her mother she was going to leave, but she'll be right back. She left in her car, and she told her mother that she was going to get something to eat and clean out her car. She was at the M&M Mini Mart at 5:15. Another report says 5:30. Yesterday, I told you I was working on the case, and there was like a discrepancy in the time. So
yeah,
it's like a 15-minute discrepancy in these reports that I saw. But anyway, we're going to say 5:15. She was at the Mini Mart, and she bought $14 in gas. She was seen on CCTV, and the gas station was about a mile from where she was found. Around 5:45, she called her mom to say she'd be back in a little bit. Cell phone records then placed her for 10 to 15 minutes in the area of a stoplight on Highway 6 headed towards Batesville, Mississippi, which is about an 8-minute drive. And that was about 6:30 p.m. At 7:30 p.m., it shows that she drove to the area where she was found. And what happened between 6:30 and 7:30 just seems to be a mystery. Because she was found about 8:10. The men that called the fire department, I think it was about 8:09, 8:10 time frame. So in the beginning, investigators believed the incident to be gang-related. Apparently, she was hanging around gang members. Jessica's dad said that she had told him several times that some in her circle suspected that she had been snitching on them because he was a mechanic for the sheriff's department or the sheriff's office. So several gang members were arrested on unrelated charges and questioned about the incident. None of them led investigators anywhere, and they were all cleared of suspicion. I read in another report that like 150 people were questioned.
Wow. Jeez.
So investigators dug in hard on the name Eric. They searched her phone on Facebook for anyone that might know, or anyone that she might know named Eric, or Derek. She didn't have anyone in her contacts list named Eric. They did come across an Eric and a Derek on her Facebook, and both men were questioned. And they were cleared due to their alibis.
Okay.
A report on people.com said Jessica's mother suggested that her daughter may have been trying to tell first responders something else after possibly awaking from unconsciousness to find herself on fire and not knowing what happened. Her mother said maybe she thought she was in a wreck, saying Eric, wreck. Eric.
Uh-huh.
Sounds similar. But the firefighter said that they could tell that that she said she was set on fire. They said, what happened to you? And one of them said that she said, I was set on fire.
Wow. Oh, my Lord.
A further dive into her text message history showed that she had been messaging a man named Quentin Tellis. And if you think about it, if your body's 93% burned, your speech would probably be affected. Her tongue was swollen. Mm-hmm. Do you remember in elementary school when we'd say, hold your tongue and say apple? I don't mean to make it funny, but that's what it reminds me of, is how her speech would be. So if you held your tongue and said, tell us, maybe it would sound like, you know, in a Mississippian accent, a Southern accent, saying tell us, maybe it might sound like Derek or I don't know. So, in these messages, Quentin had asked Jessica several times to have sex, and she repeatedly declined and rejected him. The two of them grew up in the same area, and he had gone to the same school as her, but in different years. Quentin was older than Jessica. They were introduced by a friend, and they exchanged phone numbers on November 29th of 2014, just a couple weeks prior to the incident. So, and Quentin had just got out of jail when he met Jessica. He was in for he was in for burglary and drug charges. So he had already had a record. We'll jump forward about a year later. Quentin was interviewed on November 2nd of 2015. So during the course of the interview, there were moments where he would seem comfortable and answered questions. Then he would get frustrated. At one point, he told the detective to get out of his way, and he just walked out of the interview room.
Don't be rude.
Yeah. So apparently, Quentin, detectives noticed that he had burn scars.
And they
asked him about it. Well, he did have an explanation. He couldn't remember what day, but he claims the injuries were from a bonfire. He had been hanging out with friends around a fire pit, and he thought he would be funny and jump over a barbecue grill. He landed, and as he landed, he fell into a fire pit, and the friends helped him up. I don't know if investigators followed up on that. Like, what friends were there?
Yeah.
Did he go to the...
Sounds easy to verify. Right. You know.
He did admit that he had asked Jessica several times to have sex, but she declined every time, except they did have sex one time in her car outside of his mother's house.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
In a discreet location.
Mm-hmm. Watching the investigators ask him in the interrogation room, they're like, where did y'all have sex? And he's like, outside of my mother's house. And they're like, on the grass.
Like, could you be more specific?
Yeah. Wow. So it was in her car. And they're like, her car was really tiny. Like, how did y'all do that? You're a big guy, but... So he repeatedly changed his story about the events of this day. On December 6th, he insisted that he saw Jessica earlier in the day when they were driving around with her friend. He said that he gave Jessica a joint, and he was in the back seat while Jessica and her friend were in the front smoking weed. Initially, he claimed to have only been with her during the morning. He claimed that he had gone to a store in Batesville around the time of her murder. And surveillance video did show Quentin at the store at about 8:26 p.m. So more than 15 minutes after the fire was discovered.
So he could have gotten there.
Right. Detectives confronted him with surveillance footage and cell phone records that showed them together that night. And Quentin then claimed that his final interaction with Jessica was when he gave her $10 for Taco Bell that afternoon.
Huh.
Location from their cell phone records showed that they were together until around 7:30.
Oh.
Quentin had traveled to and from Batesville at the time, or at the same time as Jessica. When told of this, he changed his story, saying that he was with her till about around 7 p.m. He told detectives that he was hanging out with his friend Big Mike. They were just hanging out in Big Mike's truck that evening. Come to find out, Big Mike was in Nashville for a football game. So that disproves his alibi. Jessica's cell phone location, the data, and CCTV from the M&M gas station indicated that she left at 7:30 and drove to the area where she was later found on fire. And by the way, Quentin's home is across the street from M&M gas station.
Don't.
So from 6:49 to 7:26 p.m., five other women were trying to contact Quentin on his phone, and he didn't respond. He was unavailable at that time. So neither he nor Jessica were on their phones at that specific time. His DNA was found on her car keys that were found 2 days later. When detectives asked him if he ever drove her car, he told them he did drive it once, and she was in the passenger seat when they went to the liquor store, but he didn't say which day that was. So Jessica's keys, where the area where they were found was between the crime scene and Quentin's sister's house.
Oh.
CCTV showed a vehicle believed to be Quentin's sister's SUV stopping at his home at about 7:50 p.m. It shows Quentin pulling into his driveway to a storage shed where he allegedly told authorities in one interview that he kept a 5-gallon gas can in that storage shed.
Okay. So
he offered up that information.
Okay, just tell.
Right. So after he went to the storage shed, he got back into the truck, he left the driveway, and drove towards the crime scene. But that was at 7:50. So, and then she was found at around 8:10 with the burning vehicle.
That's quick.
Yeah.
That's really quick for that whole area to go up in flames.
So, right. There are ways that it could have been a quick run to
back. He doused it in gasoline.
But this, we'll get into something in just a minute that will kind of explain how he may have gotten there faster. So another CCTV video shows a vehicle matching the description of Quentin's sister's SUV, which he borrowed. The SUV was speeding towards Batesville, I'm assuming to get to the store where he was seen on CCTV at 8:26. So also something noteworthy is that all surveillance videos that were reviewed showed that he had changed his clothes 3 times that day.
Wow.
Maybe he just had a lot of outfits he wanted to show off.
Yeah, probably not.
The last data shown on her phone was about 8:04 p.m., which detectives think was when her phone shut off from being too hot. And actually, when the cell phone was found, the back of it was separate from the cell phone.
Oh, and I was going to ask you where it was found. Was it
away
in the car or on
the car? Away from the car. Yes.
So, like, maybe she had it on her.
She could have.
Like, in her pocket or something?
She could have. Maybe the back of it was blasted off whenever it got too hot.
Wow.
Or that was noted was that the back of it was separate from the phone. But so 8:04 is when there was like nothing else to record on her cell phone data.
Yeah.
And by the way, do you say data or data?
You know, it's funny. I used to say data, but when I was in college, because I was working with data, all my professors said data and I just
stuck with it.
Started
okay,
saying
I'll data.
Yeah.
pretend I've been saying Data the whole time. Okay.
Okay.
And so also, Quentin had erased all of his text messages and evidence of Jessica out of his phone.
Oh my gosh. Come on, guy. Yeah.
So when they asked him about this, he said he deleted the data because he did not want a dead person's information in his phone.
I'm sorry. Mm.
Let's just pause here for a second.
Quentin.
I know. Doesn't look good.
No.
Okay. So with all of the cell data, the text messages, the suspicions from the burn marks that he had, all the changing stories, prosecutors felt that they had a really good case against Quentin. They felt that his motive was because he didn't like the rejection from her.
No, they never do.
So in February of 2016, a few months after the interview with him, Quentin was indicted on a capital murder charge in Jessica's murder.
Good.
He had prior convictions for burglary, drug possession, and fleeing from police. He had also been arrested in 2015 for the murder of another woman.
What?
And her name was Meng Chin Sao. And I hope I'm saying that right. We can get into that story in just a minute. We're going to talk a little bit about the trial and the prosecution.
Okay.
Prosecutors believed that while in Quentin's driveway, he tried to have sex with Jessica. However, she resisted. They believe that he became enraged and suffocated her until she was unconscious. In order to distance himself from the crime, he then drove her car to the area where it was later found. He then ran on foot to his sister's home nearby, took her car, picked up gasoline from his home, returned to Jessica's car, and set it on fire with her inside. Quentin's defense claimed that the person who Jessica identified as Eric or Derek was the real killer. Like, they honed in on that specific. And it's hard. Like, yeah, that's a specific name, but...
Yeah.
Half of the witnesses say that she had a difficult time talking, and then the others were like, yeah, no, she said Eric. So, but the cell phone information appears incriminating, but cell phone tower pings are said to not always be conclusive, especially in country areas where they're just a few towers. I mean, they lived in a small town of 500 people. Of course, their phones are going to ping off the same towers.
Right.
But the fact that their phones are pinging in the same areas throughout Cortland and Batesville at the same time.
Right.
That's...
Like, what are the odds of that?
It's a little sussy.
Yeah.
In the ambulance, another first responder asked, "Did Eric do this to you?" And she replied with what sounded like, "No." So she was trying to communicate who did it to her, but they were like, "He did this to you." And she's like, "No."
Yeah. And I'm wondering now, like, maybe, I mean, she was burned. Mm-hmm. She was probably hallucinating. Right. She probably couldn't really hear very well. Maybe she misunderstood what they were asking.
Right.
And they misunderstood what she was saying. So then,
that's,
you know what I mean?
That's interesting that you say that, because reading all the reports and listening to the trial, I didn't get through the whole trial, but they were so pinpointed on her speech and not her hearing.
Right.
I
mean, if you think that one faculty is diminished, you have to.
Right.
Like, she probably couldn't breathe
and
very
well.
And they did
say
she probably,
that, yeah.
Like, just think of, like, a fire. Like,
yeah, you...
It probably singed her... If it singed her nose, you know, like, she had soot in her nose, she probably had soot in her ears, to be
honest.
And,
I mean, yeah. It was a horrific scene what they walked up on. Listening to the trial broke my heart because of how they were describing her, and you could tell they were emotional. Anyway, it's making me emotional right now.
I can't imagine how she must have felt coming to in a car that was engulfed in flames, and she was on
fire. And the fact that she could get out and stop the fire.
That's what's amazing. On herself. She got out and, like, walked away so far that the people who found the car couldn't even see her.
Right.
That's...
Yeah, I mean, she was strong in her last moments, for sure.
Yeah.
A doctor later testified that there was no way Jessica could have articulated or enunciated words at that point. Like I said, the trial was very pinpointed on her speech, because that was the defense. That's really all they had was, she said Eric. Yeah.
Maybe she said did. Like, who did this to you?
Okay, well, so
a dick.
I'll tell you some words that they heard from her, like they sounded out the words of what they heard here in just a minute. So an EMT testified that Jessica's face was severely burned, with skin hanging off her lips and coming out of her nose. They said her hair was singed, like it literally looked like she put her finger in a light socket. Her hair was just fried.
Bless her, Jesus.
Oh. So he said she was hard to understand. She had a raspy, deep voice. He said that Jessica spoke three words to him and that they were all distorted. One of them was "oh," which he interpreted to be cold. Apparently burn victims get really cold. I didn't know that till I listen to the trial, but another word was "ersy," in which he interpreted as thirsty. And then the last word he says is "ewe," which he took as Eric. So he said it sounded like "ewe." But there were about 8 first responders, and some of them, like I said, they were adamant that she said Eric. And she was only speaking one word at a time, not full sentences. Deputy Daryl House testified that they asked Jessica if her attacker was black or white, and she told them that he was black. He said she could barely speak. I asked her if it was her boyfriend, and she said no. Quentin Tellis is black. The prosecution focused on the fact that most witnesses noted that the fire was contained inside of the car and spread to a tree. It was noted that if the car was set on fire by an electrical issue, the fire would have spread onto the grass and caused a grass fire. But it was all contained in the car, and then the tree caught on fire next to it. So, yeah, watching the clips of the court case and listening to all these first responders, thinking of what every first responder goes through, it's heart-wrenching. Our first responders are truly amazing, and it takes special people to do that job.
Yeah. I mean, they have no idea what they're rolling up on. Right. Like, often they have no idea. Right. They just...
Yeah, and so y'all are special people. Thank you for what you do, and I pray that God protects you every day and gives you strength and peace through what you endure. So Lieutenant Edward Dixon testified about processing the scene. He told the jury that he found her cell phone not far from the burning car. The back of it was separated. I know I'm repeating myself, but this is...
Did they... differentiate between it was like physically just taken off or it looked like it was broken off?
So no, like, yeah, that's what I'm speculating. Like, was it, that's a question I had. The only thing that they mentioned about that was it was separated. And so I'm thinking when it got hot, I mean, I've seen pictures of cell phones where if they get hot, they kind of
explode.
It was noted several times that the passenger seat was reclined. Another witness came forward. Her name is Sherry Flowers. She testified on the stand about what she had witnessed and experienced. She had just been to a funeral for her cousin on the same day, December 6th, when the weather started to get cold. She packed up her grandchildren to take them home to get their coats. On the way back, Sherry saw a man flagging her car. She presumes him to be Quentin. Oh. She thought he was a family member, and so she stopped the car. He told her his aunt's home was on fire and he needed to get there to check on her. She asked him, "Who's your aunt?" And he said, "Julia Chambers," which has no relation to Jessica Chambers.
What? Is that really his aunt's name?
Yes. Yes. And she testified on the stand as well, his aunt. So Julia Chambers, his aunt, no relation to Jessica Chambers. So Sherry knew Julia Chambers and told him that she would give him a ride to her house, even though she didn't know Quentin. He ended up telling her to drop him off at the intersection of old Highway 51 and US 51.
What?
Not far from Julia Chambers' home.
That's weird.
Yeah. So just drop me off here. I can walk.
I'm in a hurry to get to this house that is on fire, but you know what? Drop me off here and I'll walk the rest of the way.
Right.
What?
Yeah. So Julia Chambers' daughter, which I guess would be Quentin's cousin, she testified that she is related to Quentin and that he did not stop by to check on Julia Chambers that night. Huh? Julia Chambers took the stand next, and she said, to her knowledge, Quentin never reached out in any way to check on her.
And was there any indication that her house might have been on fire?
So it didn't say anything about her house being on fire, but firefighters did on the stand testify that they went to a call to a house that had smoke inside. And during that time of year in the winter, everybody turns their heaters on and it causes there's a reaction
dust.
And it gets smoke.
Yeah, the
so,
dust will.
I don't know exactly the reaction, but yeah, there was a home that was smoky inside. They went and checked it out. There was no fire. It was just because the heater was turned on the first time for the winter. So if that was Julia Chambers' house, it was not specified. That would have been nice to know. But authorities speculated that the hitchhiker, presumed to be Quentin Tellis, already knew about a fire, which put the time that Sherry picked him up well within the time frame of when Quentin would have been trying to get back to his sister's house from the scene of Jessica's death.
Yeah, he's stupid. I just feel like there's so many more excuses he could have said, like, my sister's pregnant and she's in labor, or he could have said 50 other things.
Right.
Other than, I think my aunt's house is on fire.
I don't know. Maybe he thought maybe he figured this older woman knew his aunt, because his aunt was a hairdresser in the area. Uh-huh. So I guess she was popular in the area. So maybe he thought if he said her name, she would be like, oh, okay, I feel comfortable with you because I know your aunt. I don't know.
But fire.
Right.
An idiot. I'm glad he's an idiot.
This case, y'all. So also Sherry, the lady who picked him up, she lives at 74 Main Street. She picked up the hitchhiker just leaving her house, and Deputy Tyler Mills testified that Jessica's keys were found at 124 Main Street in the path of the direction he was going.
Right.
So the outcome, okay. In October 2017, Quentin finally went on trial for Jessica's murder. The verdict was read as, drumroll please, not guilty.
Shut up.
Apparently.
No.
Apparently, the jury misunderstood the instructions. Many of them had voted for guilty. An hour later, they returned and said that they could not reach a verdict. So in a video clip of the trial, it shows the judge asking for the verdict and asked if each juror agreed. You can hear one juror saying, yes, we all voted guilty. And another juror in the background says, no, I did not agree. And the judge is like, wait, it's not unanimous? And he's like, no, I did not agree. So since the vote was not unanimous, a mistrial was declared. If he was convicted, he would have had the death penalty. And so if there's that question in your mind, like, no, he said Eric, or she said Eric, I don't know. There was so much evidence and pictures and...
I think you have to consider the fact that she was not, like, her faculties were failing her at that moment.
Absolutely.
She couldn't really speak. And the other thing, you know, I always go to psychology. When we remember an event, often we remember it different than it actually happened. It's called a flashbulb memory.
Oh, okay.
And so sometimes, like, we'll remember an event and we'll be like, no, I specifically remember it happened this way. And we'll solidify in our mind what we feel like may have happened, or, you know, and we'll fill in little gaps. Like, that's just how our brains work, because we want to put the pieces all together, like, looking back. So I'm thinking, like, you know when someone suggests something to you and you're like, oh, yeah, I remember it that way.
Mm-hmm.
I just wonder if one of the first responders said, it sounded like she said Eric, and then another one agreed, oh, yeah, she said Eric or Derek. And maybe they have their radio going and, you know, there's people there and they're trying to work on her. I just feel like they could understand certain things, like her saying no, because that seems like a really simple thing to understand. But Eric or Derek, I have trouble when there was no association, really.
Right.
No one in her life that was super close with her. Now, if she had like a best friend named Eric or Derek.
Right.
It was very, very close to someone. And then there was all this evidence to suggest maybe they had something to do with it.
Yeah.
But I just feel like that name, you just have to kind of disregard stuff that when there's an overwhelming, you know, bit on the other side of the pendulum.
Oh, yeah.
It just seems like, I don't know, you just, sometimes you have to disregard things that are not relevant because it doesn't feel like that's relevant.
Yeah, and maybe I can see this juror being like, I don't want to send this man to the death penalty.
Right.
If he didn't do it. So it's that reasonable doubt, you know? Was it reasonable? I don't know. I wasn't in the trial. I did watch bits and pieces, which seemed damning.
So did they try him again?
So yes. A new trial began on September 24th of 2018 in a different county. However, the new jury was unable to reach a verdict.
Elena!
So another mistrial was declared.
Ay, Dios mío.
Prosecutors are deciding whether to try Quentin a third time for Jessica's murder. I think the decision will be made when they see the outcome for the trial of Meng Chen Sao.
Okay, let's talk about that then.
Mm-hmm. In February of 2019, he was indicted on murder charges in her case.
And I assume that wasn't admissible in trial.
Right, like, you're correct.
Okay.
Yeah. He was transported back and forth from Mississippi to Louisiana because Meng Chen's murder was in Louisiana. So her murder was in 2015. So Jessica's was in 2014. He, somewhere in the mix, he went to, he got married to a lady
named,
what was her name? Yeah, I don't know. I can't remember her name. I meant to put it in the report, but it didn't say much about her. It just said her name. And I wish they would talk about interviewing her.
Yes, please.
But they don't.
So he just gets married and then kills someone else in the space of a year?
Right. Yeah.
Wow.
And so in 2015 was Meng Chen's murder, but he's not indicted on that until February of 2019.
Wow.
So Meng Chen Sao, like I said, I don't know if I'm saying that right. She was 34. She was a Taiwanese graduate student at the University of Louisiana at Monroe. So that indictment alleges that Quentin stabbed her more than 30 times in her face and body with a knife to get her to reveal her debit card's PIN number before killing her on July 29th of 2015.
Oh my God.
He began using her credit or her debit card that night that she was murdered.
Ugh, idiot.
Police found her body 10 days later when a neighbor called about inactivity at her apartment. Detectives connected him to that murder when security footage showed the two of them together. One of Meng Chen's neighbors provided police with a license plate number of a man who gave her a creepy feeling and was arguing with Meng Chen that day. And that neighbor later identified Quentin as the man.
Wow. Were they friends? Did he know her or did she know him?
They had a, it was said that they had a romantic relationship.
Oh.
Or a physical.
Sexual.
Yeah. Oh. Thank you. He did plead guilty in the case to unauthorized use of her debit card, but pleaded not guilty to her murder, of course. So Meng Chen's murder investigation in Louisiana helped lead investigators in Mississippi to Quentin. So it's all like tying together.
Yeah.
The trail in Mississippi was going cold when Quentin got arrested in Louisiana. The Louisiana police called and notified Mississippi State Police that they had someone in custody from Cortland, Mississippi. The trial for Meng Chen had several delays. In the latest report on November 2nd of 2022, 26 days ago?
Wow.
The judge dismissed the case.
Elena Ray.
I have a hard time just saying that. Fourth Judicial District Court Judge Larry Jefferson dismissed the indictment against Quentin on the basis of information that the state of Mississippi wanted Quentin to serve a 5-year prison sentence for other offenses.
What?
So you're just gonna dismiss?
No. No, that's not how that works, sir.
I don't understand that. Okay,
that's
I'm not
how that works.
I would not think so.
I mean, I'm not a judge or a lawyer, but I know that's not how that works.
So the Second Circuit Court of Appeal will decide whether he stands trial in the future after serving his current sentence on the charges of unauthorized card use and possession of marijuana. For that, he was sentenced to serve 10 years. Officials say that the state of Louisiana has issued an appeal already for this ruling. So as of now, the majority of the ones who worked on Jessica's case have either retired or moved to different departments. So some say and hope that a new set of eyes on the case can bring some closure, and if he gets another trial, hopefully when he gets another trial. My question is, how can you be caught up in two murder cases in two different states in which circumstantial evidence in both cases can put you right in the middle of all of it. And yet you're found not guilty in one case and dismissed in another. Like, if he's truly not guilty in either case, what kind of curse does he have on his life? Like,
Right. It's like he's just so unlucky that he just happens to be entangled with two murder victims. Like,
it doesn't make sense. But if he truly is guilty, at least he's still in prison. And hopefully there can be a resolution before he gets back out on the streets. It's,
please. I can't believe this. Like, I just really can't. I have no words.
No.
I mean, I have words, but this is a family show.
Yeah.
Wow. I hope you, like you said, a fresh set of eyes.
Yeah.
A new perspective. And I think what I said about disregarding things that may not be important or may be misremembered, because you don't want to discredit a first responder.
Right.
But sometimes we intend, our intentions are really good, and we're trying to remember all the details of something, and they could have just misremembered, or,
one of the firefighters that testified, he said he honestly could not make out what she was trying to say. And in his report that night, the report that he wrote up, he said, I asked her who did this, and she said, Eric. But on trial, he was like, I honestly couldn't tell you. And there, so the defense was like, well, why did you in your report say she said Eric? And he said, I think I was just so, I had so
like
much.
He was just trying to help.
Yeah. Like, he, what word did he use? I can't remember what your word, but basically he was so in a daze, is what he said, that he just went off of what the other firefighter said. Mm. Like, he heard them say, oh, she said Eric. So he went along with it.
Yeah. I mean, definitely that. I would think that happens. I think you, like, lean on your colleagues when maybe you are trying to figure things out at the scene. And, you know, if they could present, like, if the prosecution could get psychology and memory involved in the next trial, maybe they'll have a shot at getting the jurors to understand that sometimes we may have the best intentions, but we don't always remember things the way they were. And you need to focus on the actual evidence.
Yeah. Yeah.
That is available.
The incident was in 2014. The first trial was in 2017. And yes, you would think first responders wouldn't forget that kind of scene. But at the same time, like you said, emotions are high. This is someone that they know. Her physical state was, I mean, they were emotional on stand. Like, you're right. It's all the psychology of it is there.
Yeah, and like, to that point, how many scenes have they seen in that amount of time? How many, and like, maybe they've never seen anything like that before, but I'm sure they've rolled up on car accidents where maybe somebody was still alive. And, you know, you kind of, like I said, you're trying to make sense of something that does not make sense.
Right.
And so you're trying to fill in gaps.
Right.
And I think that's why one of the reasons eyewitness testimony is not the most reliable. We are human and we remember things differently, but we also, we may have the best intentions and we may be trying to fill in those gaps and help. Like, I can imagine the first responders are like, we got to get whoever did this. We got to get answers from her. And they're just trying to help. But sometimes I just can't believe they disregarded all the actual circumstantial evidence they had.
Well, and like I said, it seemed that there was one juror that just didn't agree. But in two trials, they could not come to an agreement.
I just feel like driving over to Mississippi and having a word with the new DA. Like,
yeah, maybe.
Oh, I'll make a phone call tomorrow.
Let me know how that goes.
Okay. Well, I am fired up.
Yeah.
I don't appreciate that, Lena.
Sorry.
I'm left speechless. What an injustice. What an injustice. Two women.
Yeah. I agree with you.
Well, thanks for that.
Well, this was great. Let's do it again sometime.
Yeah, let's do it, but not this one. Not like this.
Yeah. All right, guys. We'll see y'all next week. Bye-bye.
Bye, guys.
Well, thank you for listening to Cousins on Crime. If you're enjoying our podcast, please leave us a 5-star rating so that other true crime fans can find us.
If you have any case suggestions or just want to say hey, email us at cousinsoncrime@gmail.com. And be sure to follow us on Instagram, where we post case photos and information at Cousins on Crime Podcast.
At Ability Chiropractic, we believe every child deserves to grow up healthy, strong, and connected to the incredible power within their own body. From infants to adults, our doctors specialize in purposeful chiropractic care that restores balance between the brain and body, helping you and your family live and heal the way you were designed to, naturally. Families across Columbus are choosing to build lifelong wellness from the start. Discover what true health feels like at Ability Chiropractic. Schedule your visit today at abilitychiro.com.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.